This is Radio Free Townsend Hall, brought to you by the School of Information Science and Learning Technologies on the campus of the University of Missouri-Columbia. This is the Library and Information Science Fireside Chat Hour, coming to you regularly at this time every week. Your hosts and topics will change from week to week, but stick around and listen anyway. Who knows what might be learned? And now, from the beautiful Verizon Room in the basement of Townsend Hall, here's this week's host.
Gee, what a great introduction. Maybe somebody should hire that guy for something or other. Anyway, this is Charlie Seavey, the professor. Basically, this evening we're aiming this whole conversation at the 9410 class, Social Constructs of Information, or Wild-Eyed Social Theory, as it's known in some circles. The toll-free number, if you're outside of Columbia, is 866-768-5483, and our highly trained staff are ready to take your call. If you're in Columbia and not actually in the studio, and we do have a small gang in here tonight, the number is 884-3803. Or if you're just feeling a little twitchy about talking into the phone and having people listen, I have my ever-trusty laptop up, hooked up to the dear old wireless system, and I can get email at a moment's notice. So everything is there. We've given you every conceivable method of communication short of throwing things at me, and I take kind of a dim view of that. Hey, the audience is getting unruly. And remember, I know who you are, and I know where your grade sheets are. So there will be no throwing things at the professor. This is just not acceptable behavior. Okay, it's 866-768-5483 or 884-3803. And I'm going to start in on, unless somebody rings the bell almost immediately, on some of the emails that I got from a few of you who were actually brave enough to have questions. And let's see, what do we got here? Nicole Bouchard asks, she's been reading about Gramsci and his views on education, and in the David Forgax text, which I trust you've all read, Gramsci talks about how middle and high school should be only for students who can demonstrate that they are worthy of that level of education. He then goes on to say that the proletariat needs an educational system that's open to all, and he feels that education is more than just memorizing facts and information, but a higher awareness of oneself. I hope it's more than memorizing facts and information. And Nicole says that it seems like he's arguing with himself by limiting higher levels of education to only students who have demonstrated that they are smart enough for the opportunity. How can students reach this level of self-awareness that Gramsci wanted if they were deemed unworthy of educational opportunities at such a young age? And what can I say? He is arguing with himself, at least from my point of view. Now, one of the things that I'll have to qualify that with is that I don't know enough about the Italian education system at that time, which would have been the 1920s, possibly as late as the 30s, to fully be able to get around exactly what Gramsci was talking about when he was talking about middle and high schools. It was clearly not the system that we have here in this country. In general, European and Eastern, particularly the Japanese and some of the other school systems, And for that matter, to an extent in the UK, you do have, there are tests at every sort of grade level, as we think of, and people can get pigeonholed into various tracks. So if you want to jump, if suddenly at age 18 you've been identified as in the mechanic track, and you decided you want to be a philosophy professor, you're out of luck, basically, because you've been cast in this track. And one of the glories of the American education system, I think, is that it's if you want to shift gears, it's there for you to shift gears. I just barely graduated from high school, and when I decided that working on the frozen fish pier was not a career path that I particularly wanted to pursue, college was there, and I could get in. I went to a, you know, fairly nice state-level college. When I decided in my 30s that I wanted to get a master's degree, I did so. When I was in my 40s and decided I wanted to get a PhD, it was all there for me. And I don't think I could have done this in Europe. Certainly not. Maybe now I could have. I'm not sure. But certainly not at the time I was in high school. Had I been a European kid, I'd still be on that frozen fish I fear. And I greatly suspect that the educational system that Gramsci is basing this argument on is a good deal more restrictive than what we've got in the United States, and that people were stopped probably, or not stopped, I guess, but labeled and put into a track, and there you shall stay for the rest of your life. And I suspect that when he says the proletariat needs an educational system that's open to all, it there's probably two sides to all that. I think what he was probably saying is it needs to be open in the fact of opportunity, and maybe that higher awareness can get you there when you're ready to do it, much the way I sort of blundered through my education. My mother always said that all us three boys were late bloomers, and maybe she was right. As I said, I just really don't know enough about the Italian educational system at that time to be able to give you a good detailed answer on that question. On the other hand, Nicole, if you feel so inclined, feel free to investigate this further on your own. And we'll see where we are. Okay, the number is 866-768-5483, and the local number is 884-3803, and I will dodge over and check the old email here. This wireless stuff is pretty cool. I'm fond of this. Hey, Dan. The audience is growing by the minute. This thing is awfully loud. We're playing with the technology here. There we go. That's better. I was breaking my own eardrum, so. Anybody that thinks we've got all this nailed down tight is confused. There's always about a half an hour getting this thing set up. There's more wires and whatnot that you can possibly imagine. And we had three people standing around the mixing board at one point trying to figure out what was going on. No, really, Paul knows everything that's going on. So I've got another message here. This is from Carly Bachman. This came in earlier today. And she said she was staring into her coffee this morning and ruminating on the whole thing. And I figure, hey, I do a lot of my best work early or thinking early in the morning when I'm walking the dog. So staring into the coffee has got to be a good time for thinking, too. So here's what she was thinking about. Gramsci's notion of hegemony as the dominant group's ideological, economic, moral, etc., control by consent. And can it be found in the classification and subject access schemes we've been talking about? And she claims that her understanding of this might be very shallow, i.e., by looking at how women were portrayed in the 1953 Library of Congress subject headings, we might be able to draw some inferences concerning how women were viewed by the dominant culture. First of all, am I getting even close to right? And yeah, right, you are. This great power in naming things, if you name something, if you label it, you've established, you've made that name the subject of discourse. There's a label there that then gets used. I don't know how many of you have read Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea trilogy. I'm getting some nods around in the studio here. And Science Fiction Channel, I guess, just did a not bad adaptation of it. Well, okay, I'm getting some thumbs down on that. Okay, I thought the dragon was cool. What can I say? But there's a great deal in that, in the Earthsea trilogy, about the true name of things. And one of the things that, that young Ged has to find out is the true name of it, or it saves him, in fact. Is he knows the name, the true name of the dragon that attacks him. And he weasels the true name of the other villain out of the dragon. Or, actually, I guess he doesn't, but he finds it out eventually. The point of the thing is, and it's a theme that runs through that trilogy of stories, is the true name, the power of the name. Some years back, I did, actually one of my students in Arizona did, and I helped out a little bit. We did an investigation of Library of Congress subject headings dealing with American history. Now keep in mind, this was Arizona and New Mexico, which were colonized by the Spanish long before, well, not long before, but before the English got to Massachusetts, to Virginia, all that sort of thing. But at the time, and this is going on 10, 12 years ago, and I haven't looked at it since, the subject history subject headings in Library of Congress were Colonial America, and it very clearly starts with Virginia and Massachusetts and Maine and New Hampshire, and the Spanish colonies in Florida and Louisiana and Texas and New Mexico and California might just as well not have existed at all as far as United States history meant history of the East Coast sweeping west. And all those Spanish folks that were living there at the time were purely incidental, and they don't become important. Well, you don't start looking at those areas until the east-westward sweeping United States catches up with the place. So the people in New Mexico don't really exist until 1848, when, I can't remember, Kearny's army takes over during the Mexican-American War over Texas, which was really unfortunate. We wound up getting Texas out of the deal. This is the native New Mexican in me talking here. We unfortunately got Texas. Of course, we did get the draft rights to Selma Hayek, but never mind that. That's a theme we don't want to pursue too far. There is that power of names. I mean, there's a subject access system, and it looks at the world, and it says the Spanish Crescent didn't exist. That particular group of colonists in the New World were simply not important in United States history. Well, maybe not. Maybe not. The other two, let's take a look at, where did I link them from? Course information. Hello? I think maybe my computer has gone to sleep here. Yep, internal errors. Let's see if I can get this to come up. There it is. Okay, the two papers I had you read, and it hasn't got down to the second one yet, but the paper that Elaine Cubbins, my student Elaine Cubbins, did on the treatment of Native Americans in the E classification schedule, if you've read that, you'll see that there were some very clear ways of looking at the world and some labeling. So, yeah, I think we can, and I cannot get the link to Shelley's paper to come up. Shelley's paper, as you recall, dealt with classification of homosexuals in Dewey Decimals, which didn't even exist until 1930-something. So there's a whole class of people who didn't even have a label in the system. And then for many years was, as I recall, a paper classed as a mental illness or a perversion or some damn thing. And now, to be fair to the Dewey classificationists, they were drawing directly from the American Psychological Association. Or, yeah, I'm getting some nods on that. Some gang of shrinkologists who presumably should have known better, but didn't. So, yeah, I mean, you can find out by looking at how women were treated in the 1953 Library of Congress subject headings. In fact, there's been no small amount of literature on the way women have been treated in various subject headings. I think, what's his name, Sandy Berman up at Hennepin County Library in Minneapolis wrote a number of papers on that. That he's not passed away, but he's not, actually he got fired, if I remember it, because he said, gee, maybe people should be able to read the subject headings that we're putting in there, and eventually that got him into trouble. So then Carly goes on, let's see, she's talking about Lears here, and which I had to read fairly early on. Well, the subordinate groups be unknowingly upholding and reinforcing many of the underlying hegemonic ideals, even when they're taking actions that they consider anti-hegemonic or revolutionary. Slave rebellions reinforcing patriarchy was one of his examples, which in a sense is true. If you go back to the dear old 60s, those of you who can actually remember that time, one of the things that was very true about the student revolutionary movement was that, and we're back to women again here, women were definitely in a secondary role, revolutionarily speaking, anytime there was a big march or whatnot, and the cops were there, the cry would go up, I'm not making this up, and don't throw things at me. Chicks up front, on the theory that if the women were up in the front of the mob, the cops were a lot less apt to wail on them with nightsticks than they were with the guys. So, yeah, there are, I think, so that particular part of the hegemony was being reinforced. At the same time, other parts were being challenged. I mean, nobody, you shouldn't think of the hegemony as one great monolithic thing that's nobody writes it down, okay? It's not like there's an active conspiracy where a little gang of people sit in a smoke-filled room and say, okay, this is the way it's going to be. It's much broader. Now, this is why, in a lot of ways, it's harder to get hold of than, for those of you who are in the research methods class and have read a little bit about Thomas Kuhn and paradigms. Paradigms, to me, are a lot more clear-cut because they grow out of hard sciences. Hegemony, cultural hegemony, is much more diffuse, and it's a great sort of shared belief system. I mean, at the root, we all kind of, capitalism is the way we live. And that's just, you know, there is no other way. And in truth, I like having this computer. I like my car. I'm not sure I want to get too far away from capitalism. But I also recognize there are drawbacks to the system, and some of them are fairly extreme. So that's part of what gets reinforced, even when you're being anti-hegemonic in another sense. We're dealing with subtleties here. We're dealing with ideas that are hard to get your head around sometimes. We're dealing with stuff that we grow up with, and sometimes looking at it and saying, now, wait a minute, is a very hard thing to do. In a lot of ways, the only thing I'm really trying to do with this class is to have us look at the way we do things as librarians and realize maybe there's an awful lot of stuff in here that's simply built in to reinforce the way things are, to reinforce that cultural hegemony. I'm not saying go out there and be revolutionary and burn the card catalog if anybody's still got one. In this, I've got people laughing at me here. in the 70s, when I was at the University of Northern Iowa, we still had a card catalog, and there were still the occasional student riots, although not at UNI. But honest to God, we had a plan to protect the card catalog if the rioters ever tried to take over the library. Most of those Iowa kids were just desperately trying to get through college so they could make a living and all that. Nobody ever thought of rioting against the library. But we had a plan, and we actually did microform the whole shelf list at one point so that we could recreate the card catalog in case it got burned up. I wish I was making this up, but I'm not. So, let's see. Carly doesn't think she's expert enough. Well, I'll email her on the side. Listen, are any of you guys going to call up, or am I going to have to talk myself here all night long? Heck, I get bored listening to me every now and then. The number is 866-768-5483 or 884-3803. And if any of you characters here have got things to say to add to this conversation, aside from threatening to throw things at me, okay, we have a member of the studio audience is about to say something, or several somethings, or ad infinitum. I'm sorry. Shut up, Charlie. Go ahead.
Well, you were talking about the people trying to be countered the hegemony, reinforcing certain aspects of it, and you were talking about the 60s. I was raised in their commune, Rainbow Ridge Commune, and one of the things I noticed was that the women did the cooking and the cleaning, and the men sat around doing nothing.
Smoking dope, probably.
I was four. I don't know what they were smoking.
Yeah.
But that was one of the things I noticed, and it was one of the things that my mom pointed out, because she could not stay home and clean or cook.
She couldn't cook. Yeah. Well, I mean, there are a lot of those roles that are just, even in that counter-hegemonic time, absolutely got reinforced, and I think this is not the first time I've heard this from folks who used to live in communes or nearby.
One thing I missed was they also had their own hegemony, because my dad didn't do the whole, he wasn't a vegetarian. He cooked meat, he worked and stuff, and there was a lot of people going, treating him the way they were being treated, but what they considered the counterculture, which I always thought was kind of contradictory, because they were just creating a new hegemony.
It's not that broad. I wouldn't call it, I don't think it's broad enough to be a hegemony. It's, in a way, somewhere along the line, I made a crack about Gramsci and the Italian left, and I said it was split along ideological lines and what else is new. Well, one of the things about, and I think particularly the left more than the right, is that or actually Christians are prone to doing this too, that ideological fine points will result in splits, so that this group splits off. I mean, if you look at the history of the left in almost any country, this endless procession of this group seceding from that group and these guys going off and, no, the toilet paper should come from the bottom instead of the top, and, you know, God, somebody did a poll on that a little while ago. So there's a lot of that, and it doesn't surprise me that this sort of thing was going on at that, because, you know, there's one true way, and if you're not absolutely 100% in line, you're totally vile and go away. You know, dude liked a hamburger every now and then. You know, I mean, I'm a vegetarian, but I got all kinds of friends and relatives that happily chow down on whatever the heck they want to, and I don't care. As long as they're not going to make me eat the stuff. Okay, Rachel?
I was also thinking about a very distinct aspect of American history that has the very clear decision being made about what aspects of hegemony to challenge, and that's the abolition movement, which divorced itself from the women's movement around the time of Seneca Falls and said, if we want to have no slavery, we have to attack that and not also attack women's roles in life. And you see that didn't come back for another 60 or 70 years.
When was Seneca Falls?
1848.
Oh, that early.
Well, it was on radio.
Okay. We actually got somebody on the phone here. Hold that yes, thought until we see if somebody's actually going
to... Okay, and you need to turn your speakers down, please. Okay.
I should have mentioned this at the beginning. If you're going to call, turn your computer speakers down, turn your sound system down, or you're going to get wicked back feedback and blow everybody's eardrums out. And here's Paul pressing the button. And you're on. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
How are you?
Pretty good. You're awful loud there, son. Who's
I'm
this?
Sorry.
That's okay.
That's probably
under our control. So who are you and what are you going to ask me?
This is Chad Pollack.
Chad, hi.
Calling from Texas.
Texas? How unfortunate. Uh-oh, I took offense at my crack about Texas.
That's right. I was wondering about hegemony and talking about hegemony. You say is it something that can be avoided the way we talk about it in our discussion in our class? Is it we speak of it in pejorative terms, but is it just something that occurs rather naturally that we just need to be aware of? Or is it something that we should actively fight against? Or what should our response to cultural hegemony be?
I hope it doesn't come out pejorative. My main argument simply is it exists. And in a sense, it can be benign or it can be repressive. But it's not necessarily something that we have to go out into the streets and start, you know, burning cop cars over. I don't want anybody to get the idea that this is some giant evil conspiracy I'm talking about here. It's just a broadly accepted set of beliefs about the way society is. Sometimes it has not necessarily... Well, yeah, okay. It has evil parts to it. When society believed that it was okay to have slaves. Now, that's evil. Certainly the way we look at it now, but clearly society changed on that issue.
And does it have to be, in your definition, broadly accepted to fall under the definition of hegemony?
Yeah, I think it is. It's anything that's really broadly accepted.
It has to be dominant.
Yeah, it's part of the dominant culture. It's part of the way things are. It's, in the 60s hippie commune we were talking about a couple of minutes ago, women cooked and cleaned clothes. That's part of the dominant way we live.
Yeah.
It's that sort of thing. The thing you look at and don't even question. And once it starts being questioned, as slavery got questioned eventually, as the role of women eventually got questioned, I think as the kind of repression of homosexuals is being questioned now, these are when you start looking back and saying, well, maybe that isn't the way it is. There's always the dominated groups, the subaltern groups, start getting in their own licks after a while. And eventually society changes on an issue like that. You know, and I've been talking about repressed groups here. There are probably other ways of goodness knows we've changing our attitudes about smoking. Okay, there's something that doesn't involve an actually repressed group. Is that answer, Chad?
I think so, yeah. I'm still curious, and maybe I could just throw this out there. What sort of... For information professionals, what sort of practical applications are we striving for here?
Ah, the how do we implement this?
Yeah.
Well, I got two emails from people here. In a way, this is why I've been hitting so hard on the information structures that we use, classification and subject headings. What Chad's trying to get at is, okay, what do we as information professionals do about all this? And that's why I've been looking, had you read all that Gramsci and Lears and all that stuff, and then we start looking at the way we organize knowledge, at the way we label things, at the implicit or for that matter, explicit assumptions we make in classification systems and in subject heading systems. And if you can look at, you know, the Native Americans in the E schedule and say, now, wait a minute, or like the example I gave you in this week or last week when I got talking about the Navajo Nation, which in the G classification system simply doesn't exist as except as a subset of a very large other region. And yet that thing has very well-defined borders. It's very well understood by the people living there exactly what that is. But it is a dominated culture. And you should be able to say, now, wait a minute. He says, strangely enough, I was thinking when I was driving in, I might have to play around with the schedule a little bit and see if I can come up with a number for it, if the Navajo haven't done it on themselves already, done it on their own. So is that get at part of it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's definitely something that could be discussed for a long time. But thank you for your...
Okay. No problem.
All right. Thank
and
you.
See you in class.
Okay.
Let's see. This is from Greg Stotler. This is an email. Do I personally think it's possible to create a classification system that are void of the cultural mindset? Probably not. Or is it the fact that we are evaluating and reevaluating these systems good enough for library pupils and people? Yeah. And he's got a good joke in here. As long as we teach them to do the same, void of time travel being discovered, of course, and Dr. Sam Beckett has yet to take the quantum leap. And Greg says, hola to all the peeps in the studio, although hola is spelled wrong, but we'll discuss that later. No, I don't think it's possible to build a classification system or subject access system that doesn't have some kind of viewpoint in it. I mean, I can't imagine. There is no such thing as a value neutral system. It just depends on whose values, how aware you are of your own values, and how much you're willing to build into that. You know, if we hold to the vision of the United States that ignores the Spanish Crescent or doesn't recognize the Navajo Nation, maybe that's a worldview we want to work on changing and building in. This is, let's face it, a multicultural country, like it or not. And some of those cultures have been here for a long, long time. It didn't all start with Plymouth Colony or what was the one down in Virginia?
Jamestown.
Thank you. Let's see. Bob Hagedorn, just a comment on Gramsci and education. I'm no expert on Italian education. Well, welcome to the club. Italy may have had a common system of grammar education for young children, and then sending them on to either agricultural or apprenticeship or in a skilled trade. Yeah, this is ringing. It sounds likely. Middle school, high school, and college were reserved for the rich would-be professionals, the clergy, etc. The privileged few, in short. Oh, I wouldn't say that. Of course I would. Grade school dropouts were not uncommon. Such a situation may not have been considered the social economic disaster we would think of it as being. Yeah, the American educational system today is very, very different from Italy of 1920, 80-something years ago. In fact, it wasn't until, I think, after World War II that we started getting the majority of Americans actually making it all the way through high school. If it wasn't after World War II, it was very close before that, the 1940s, 1950s. Let's see. Growth of a real proletariat class in the early 20th century Italy. may have begun to upset this traditional system, thus leading to social ferment and political radicalism. And Bob is saying that Italy, in that sense, was behind England, France, and Germany, and I'd absolutely agree with that. In the growth of anything resembling a working proletariat, an industrial proletariat, they're probably still a good deal more agricultural. And Gramsci may have been drawing on this tradition. Yeah, I think, you know, the points you're making here, Bob, are very close to what I suspect is probably right. Let's see if anybody else is emailed in here. No, okay, so the phone number is 866-768-5483, or the local number is 884-3803. And we're going to go back to Rachel, who was on a theme when I shut her up because somebody, she says she's forgotten now. Don't email it to me. I'm sitting right here. This is carrying technology just a little bit too far. Thank you very much.
I think this is kind of related to what Greg emailed in about. I was thinking, well, starting when I was talking about the extension service on the blackboard, about how there are different levels of knowledge, like catalogers know a lot about cataloging and farmers know a lot about farming. So that necessarily the catalogers don't know what the farmers know and can't reflect that. But also it happens within when we're trying to create a new system. So when we have, like, the women's thesaurus, the women, I assume they're women making it, they're approaching it as women, but also as catalogers. And so the real question is, with Marxism in general, and probably Hegel too, although I haven't read Hegel, is praxis actually possible? You know, can we combine those two people to make something wholly new?
Yeah, I don't see why not. I'm trying to see if I can read the authors of the women's. I'm sure it was two women, and I can't see who it was. Yeah, Mary Ellen Capick, and there was somebody from the University of Wisconsin that was involved in the women's thesaurus too. I think the fact that what did I pull up in that lecture? 300 thesaurus lists, something like that, playing with Merlin, and I'm sure there are a good deal more than that. There's always going to be a actually somebody had a good question. Okay, I'll do a riff on this. There's always going to be subject-specific language that's known to a small group. The farmers have got very specific language when they're dealing with soil conditions, with crops, with all that kind of thing. One of the examples I use in the research methods course is I'll eventually get around, I'll talk about soybeans. And I'll say, from my point of view, I've met one soybean, I've seen them all. My brother-in-law, the soybean farmer, can go on ad infinitum about differences in soybeans that come out of his various fields and the soil conditions and where the sun is and the slope of the land and all this stuff. When we're building a big general subject heading system like Library of Congress subject headings, it's aimed in a sense at a generalist audience, not at a specialist audience. So we don't include all that stuff that Rick is carrying around in his head about soybeans or and all the other farmers up there in Iowa are, or the aeronautical engineers. What were some of the other ones that were kicking around? Anyway, you get the point. That's why we get these specialist things. And when Madame S. started fooling around with this project, and dealt with economically deprived women and their experiences, it became very obvious to her very quickly that Library of Congress subject headings was simply too broad, too generalized, and all that. And she found the women's thesaurus much more flexible and a lot more aimed at women even if in the end she said it did still have some middle-class biases built into it, because look who was writing it, you know, a bunch of middle-class librarian women, so who simply had not been economically disadvantaged, et cetera, all that kind of stuff. One of the things that I've noodled around, now somebody on the discussion board got asking about this, and I can't remember the exact wording of it, but okay, why don't we, and a question I've had for a long time, why don't we have different sets of subject headings for different topics? The only thing between us and providing many, many, many descriptors for any given thing in an OPAC has been the time to do it and server space. Now, server space is a lot smaller of an issue than it used to be. So I'm thinking, let's say your basic geology PhD student walks up to the terminal, plugs into the OPAC, and it says, do you want to use the American Geophysics Institute subject language? Do you want to use Library of Congress? Do you want to use, you know, the British Geological Society? I made that one up. You know, whatever subject language you're comfortable with looking at it. I got this idea years and years and years ago watching my daughter play early video games in a arcade, and she was selecting levels of difficulty for this thing. I didn't even know what the kid was doing. You know, stuff was happening on the screen, and she goes, well, I'm going to try level 6, and ta-da, you know. And I thought, well, you know, we could put in different sets of subject descriptors for things. We wouldn't do it for everything.
Well, it's possible in Mark, too.
But it's possible in Mark. And, you know, we're not bound, as somebody said on the discussion board, we're not bound anymore by what will fit on a 3x5 card or two or three 3x5 cards. All we're bound by is how many whatever the heck field it is, you know, that we want to put in there. And I think we're fooling around, we're starting to play around with putting chapter headings in, things like that. I'm thinking, why don't we look at some alternative subject heading systems? You know, the poor catalogers, I mean, LCSH is 4 big fat books about that big. You know, how hard would it be to add a few other things in there? Well, I don't know. You know, it's just an idea. Of course, I'm just a guy that has ideas now. I don't have to actually implement this stuff. And I'm sure that Madam S. would tell me at great length why we probably couldn't do that. But I still think it's an idea, at least worth exploring. I mean, when the Library of Congress first started fooling around with the idea of automating cataloging back in the early 60s, there were an awful lot of people that said, you're out of your mind. You can't do that. It has to be done that. Probably when we started using typewriters and got away from teaching you master's students library hand, there were people that said, oh, this will never do. We can't do it that way. It's always been done this way. Totally ignoring the fact that card catalogs themselves were a relatively recent innovation at that stage of the game. What started me off on this? What did you ask me?
I asked you about developing new either subject heading systems or classing systems as a minority group, but also as the sort of traditional intellectual that the librarian is, like, is, you know, I think that there's a point where you're like, well, I want to do all of these things that would support my counter-hegemonic struggle, but because I am a cataloger, I have to do it this way.
Yeah. There are the rules. I mean, you know, in a way, that's what Sandy Berman was arguing all those years. Go look him up in library literature, and you may actually have to look at paper indexes for a while. And here's an argument, you know, bless the Library of Congress. I mean, they've got this great, enormous, huge collection there. They got to get some kind of handle on the thing. And we have to remember that it is literally the Library of Congress. It's not a national library. Congress controls the purse strings very tightly, to the point where not all that many years ago they deducted from the LC budget the amount of money that it took them to translate Playboy into Braille. I'm not making this up. So they've got this subject heading system. God, where was I going with this? There are limits to time and money. Everybody knows there are some drawbacks to the LC subject heading system. One of the things, another odd thought I've always had, is why does every library in the country say, oh, Library of Congress is doing it, therefore we have to do it? Library of Congress has got 20-something million volumes. Just books, 20 million books. You know, Bullhead City, Arizona, is never going to have that many books. Teeny tiny town in Missouri somewhere is not going to have that many books. We're not going to have that many books over in Ellis. If it works for the Library of Congress, that's fine. But look at this magnitude of the problem they've got. We're not going to have that problem. Maybe we could get a little more adventurous with subject headings. Maybe we could add some more detail to it. Just a thought. I'm not a guy that has to implement all this stuff, but that's my answer. Is, you know, we've got this slavish LC does it, so we've got to do it. Well, personally, I think we could get a little innovative every now and then. And the MARC record, you know, I know that at least one of my colleagues thinks we should get rid of MARC and all that and trade it in for the Code du Jour, and I'm thinking, what the heck? It's been working all these years. It works just fine. Every catalog in this country is based on the thing. Let's not spend millions and millions of dollars going over to something else. It's flexible enough we could do things like that. We could experiment. I keep wishing more libraries would be a little more adventurous. Okay, I've been yammering on here for about 45 minutes. Any of you characters got anything to say? Because I think we're going to wrap this baby up. I've said everything I want to say. I'm going to make one last check of the old email inbox here. And, well, that's not anything to do with this class. That's one of the doctoral students out there.
I have one last thing. So, logistical.
You've got one more last thing?
Logistical
thing. All right, fire away.
A short paper. I recall an announcement, which I can't seem to find on Blackboard, that mentioned the 27th as the due date and the 22nd as, which I wrote in my notes as, draft, March 22nd, and now I don't know what that means.
Oh, I think I probably was saying, if I recall it, let me see what the dates look like here. Yeah, what I said was, I'm pretty sure on your short paper, if you want to give me a draft before spring break. Spring break starts the 19th. The 22nd is, if we're talking about March here, if you want to give me a draft of something before we get to spring break, I will happily read it over spring break. If you're talking the 22nd of something else, I have no idea what you're talking about. But email me tomorrow, and we'll try and figure out what it is when we're not trying to wrap this puppy up, okay? I know I get a little casual about the calendar, but that's okay, because this is one of these instances where mercy is usually CV policy, because I know I'm casual about the calendar. So, okay, folks, that's it for tonight. We've spent 50 good minutes here, and actually that was Sarah Nielsen that was talking about the 3x5 card, and I didn't get to her question, but I'll email her back directly on this. Okay, Paul's going to play the exit music, and we are out of here.
And that's all for this evening. Future programs announced over the Sizzled LIS list, or watch this spot on your bookmarked Zone Radio webpage. Zone Radio managed by Chris Amelung. In the booth tonight, the ever-popular Paul Turner. Backup vocals by Judy Ritchie's Reflector Crowd, And lurking in the background, the lads from LAPS, the Learning and Performance Support Team. The intro music was by Richard Strauss. The exit tune is The Last Waltz by the band.